The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine, dated March 29th, 2013. And as usual, we'll begin with the main story section of The Week magazine. Our first article is entitled, The GOP's Sobering Self-Diagnosis. The Republican Party this past week reignited a fierce internal debate over how to change its political trajectory as many party leaders released a damning self-diagnosis of how it lost last year's presidential election. The 100-page Growth and Opportunity Project, prepared by the Republican National Committee, outlined the party's image problems in stark terms, reporting that many voters see the GOP as a scary and narrow-minded party of stuffy old men. The report said the party needed to build bridges to minority, female, and young voters, and to adopt a shortened primary season with fewer debates. RNC Chairman Rince Priebus pledged $10 million for an aggressive marketing campaign aimed at Hispanics and other minorities. The Republican Party needs to stop talking to itself, he said. Devastatingly, we have lost the ability to be persuasive with or welcoming to those who do not agree with us on every issue. The RNC's report was rejected by Tea Party activists, underlining a widening split in the party between establishment Republicans and grassroots conservatives. We don't need an autopsy report from the RNC to know they failed to promote our principles and lost because of it, said Jenny Beth Martin, co-founder of Tea Party Patriots. The RNC report came just days after the Conservative Political Action Committee, where Tea Party-aligned politicians insisted that Republicans simply needed to explain more effectively their principles of free enterprise, individual liberty, and personal responsibility. We don't need any new ideas, said Senator Mark Rubio of Florida. The idea is called America, and it still works. Now here's what the editorial said to say. The RNC's encouragingly candid report could be the beginning of the party's return to the mainstream, said the New York Times, but its recommendations don't go nearly far enough. The GOP's real problem is its extremist fixation on lowering taxes for the rich and taking an axe to social programs for seniors, the poor, and the struggling middle class. As long as it's wedded to discredited trickle-down economics, exclusionary social policies, and voter ID laws that are clearly hostile to minority voters, the GOP will continue alienating large segments of the public. The party's biggest problem in 2012 was not its policies or its extended primary process, but the quality of the candidates, said WashingtonExaminer.com. Shortening the primary calendar will only give establishment moderates like Mitt Romney a pronounced advantage over grassroots conservatives who rely on upset wins in early primaries. But an endless primary season damages all the candidates, said NationalReview.com. The unwieldy 2012 primary season of 20 debates gave President Obama a head start on fundraising and organization, while Romney and his rivals beat each other up. The GOP faces serious messaging and demographic problems, but the primary process, at least, we can change. Now here's what the columnist said. Is this a plan for the future or a suicide note, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. With its whimpering tone of surrender, this report simply repeats the liberal slander that Republicans are ideologically rigid and indifferent to the middle class. Republicans hold 30 of the nation's governorships, and the only reason we lost the presidency in 2012 was because of Obama's rock star appeal. That's delusional, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. If the GOP doesn't stop playing solely to its base in the red states and find a way to win over women, the young, and minorities, it will atrophy as a national party. Indeed it will, said Ross Douthat in NYTimes.com. But the Republicans' most fundamental problem is their deeply unpopular economic policies and their insistence that the federal government can play no beneficial role in job creation, health care, and education. As long as the GOP goes into battle behind Representative Paul Ryan's vision of a society where individuals rise and fall without help or much of a safety net, it faces a permanent minority fate. Good luck with convincing conservatives of that, said David Horsey in the Los Angeles Times. At CPAC, the fevered insular mindset that cost Republicans not only the presidency but the Senate was on full display with extreme ideologues like Sarah Palin, Rick Santorum, Donald Trump, and the NRA's Wayne LaPierre dominating the agenda. The war for the soul of the Republican Party has only just begun. The next article from the main story section of the week is entitled Obama Woos the Israelis. President Obama made his first state visit to Israel this past week, a three-day trip aimed at smoothing his administration's sometimes testy relations with the key U.S. ally in the Middle East. Obama and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu greeted each other warmly before turning to talks on the worsening conflict in Syria, Iran's nuclear ambitions, and the stalled peace process with the Palestinians. I am confident in declaring that our French is let's knock eternal, Obama said. It's about time for this charm offensive, said Amnon Lord in Marav. Israelis are wary of Obama. We know he could have prevented the Palestinians' unilateral declaration of statehood at the UN last year. And we remember his 2009 Cairo speech when he cited the Holocaust rather than 3,000 years of Jewish connection to this land as the reason for the creation of Israel. That's why Obama asserted a Zionist position the second he landed in Tel Aviv, saying he was glad to be in the historic homeland of the Jewish people. But a state visit isn't just about the people, said Janine Zakaria in Slate.com. It's also an implicit endorsement of the host government. And Netanyahu doesn't deserve one after backing Mitt Romney for president and defying Obama's every initiative. Here's what this dog and pony show will mean to Bibi. I can continue to expand settlements, focus solely on Iran, and insult the U.S. president, and he will still come and thank me. Actually, these two have a lot in common, said Peter Beinart in the DailyBeast.com. Netanyahu fears that standing up to his hard right base on the settlement issue will cost him his job, while Obama fears that standing up to Netanyahu will cost him support at home. By refusing to challenge Netanyahu's approach to the Palestinians, Obama has made it his own. Both men are betting that the Palestinians will passively accept the status quo, a very dangerous assumption. On this trip, the Palestinians take a back seat to the more pressing problem of Iran, said Jeffrey Goldberg in the Atlantic.com. Netanyahu has been pushing for military action to stop Iran's nuclear program, and he's not convinced Obama has his back. There's a greater chance Netanyahu will remain patient if Obama makes the case for patience in person and on Netanyahu's turf. The next article is entitled Pope Francis's New Approach. Pope Francis set the tone for a humbler, more caring papacy at his inauguration mass this past week, calling on the Catholic Church to serve the poorest, the weakest, and the least important, and urging world leaders to embrace the whole world with tender affection. Addressing some 200,000 faithful gathered at the Vatican, Francis paid homage to his predecessor, Benedict XVI, but where Benedict, at his installation in 2005, darkly warned of the dangers of secularism, Francis espoused a message of love for neighbor and creation. To protect every man and woman, he said, is to let a shaft of light break through the heavy clouds. That message gave hope to many in St. Peter's Square. I had lost my faith in recent years, said Maria Grazia Ceccarelli, who is 67 years old, but Francis has already called me back. Francis gives me cause for hope, too, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. The financial and sexual scandals that have torn the church apart arose from arrogance, conceit, clubbiness, and an assumption that the special can act in particular ways. By showing himself to be a true man of the people, Francis is sending a message to the Curia that he will not tolerate corruption. The new pope might be more appealing than his predecessor, said Michael Brendan Daugherty in Slate.com, but for the church, the change is purely cosmetic. Let's not forget that the cardinals who undermined Benedict's attempts at reform are still in place, and a 76-year-old Argentine unfamiliar with the Vatican's labyrinthine workings will be even easier to ignore than Benedict. Francis now has the chance to prove he's a true reformer, said Barbie Latza Nadeau in the DailyBeast.com. On his desk is an investigative report commissioned by Benedict that is thought to detail the church's many scandals. If he uses that evidence to guide a Vatican cleanup, he will turn the hope he has created into something tangible for the future of the church. And if he doesn't, the honeymoon will soon be over. Now we'll take a look at the controversy of the week from the main story section of the Week magazine. It's entitled, The Deficit. Do We Need a Balanced Budget? What is so special about a balanced budget? Asked Annie Lowry in the New York Times. That question lies at the heart of the ongoing war between Republicans and Democrats over the country's spending decisions. Republicans believe that once government spending and borrowing are cut back, private capital will rush in and create new businesses and new jobs, invigorating the economy. Democrats, however, argue that deficit spending is needed to revive the sluggish economy and that by taking on debt, the government can preserve both public and private sector jobs, put money into people's pockets, and stimulate consumer spending and growth. The ideological chasm separating the two parties was put in sharp relief last week when conservative leader Representative Paul Ryan laid out a plan to balance the budget within 10 years, mainly through severe social spending cuts. President Obama reacted by saying that deficits were not an immediate crisis, adding, "My goal is not to chase a balanced budget just for the sake of balance. My goal is how do we grow the economy?" Sorry, Mr. President, but deficits do matter, said William McKenzie in the Dallas Morning News. The Keynesian pump primers may contend otherwise, but when an economy is saddled with high levels of debt, government becomes a sponge that soaks up available capital. Our accumulated public debt is now a staggering $16.6 trillion. Fortunately, our economy hasn't yet collapsed under the weight of Washington's mountain of IOUs, but with baby boomers retiring and entitlement costs soaring, a day of reckoning is coming. Not so long ago, the president shared those fears, said David Harsanyi in Reason.com. In 2006, then-Senator Obama described America's rising debt and the hundreds of billions in interest payments taxpayers must absorb each year as a hidden domestic enemy, and called on the Bush administration to abide by the common-sense budgeting principle of balancing expenses and revenues. Obama was right. Too bad he's since grown so fond of spending other people's money. The truth is that our deficit really isn't that big a deal, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. It peaked at $1.4 trillion in 2009, but the Congressional Budget Office now projects the deficit for fiscal 2013 to be $845 billion. In other words, the deficit is falling more rapidly than it has for generations. Meanwhile, with the economy still recovering from the 2008 Great Recession, unemployment is still too high. We won't solve that problem by embracing premature austerity, a policy that has tipped Italy and the UK back into the recession. The U.S. deficit is, if anything, too small, said Ezra Klein in Bloomberg.com. Right now, the world is loaning money at interest rates of nearly 0%. We should take up that generous time-limited offer and pass a tax cut for employers who hire new workers and rebuild our crumbling infrastructure at bargain basement rates. This is the time to spend, not cut. Sadly, our political leadership is frozen in this endless debate, said Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post. Meanwhile, it's ignoring the reality that in a decade, Social Security and Medicare costs for aging baby boomers will force major tax increases on the young and draconian cuts on every other federal program, from defense to education to law enforcement. This year's deficit matters a lot less than what we do about the giant deficits to come, which so far is nothing. Choices are being made by default. Now, from the Week magazine, we will turn from the controversy to the popular column Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for Turnabout after an activist, Aaron Jackson, bought the house opposite the famously homophobic Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, Kansas, and painted it the rainbow colors of gay pride. His message, Jackson said, was, "Where there's hate, there's also love." It was a good week for show and tell after a Michigan middle school student turned up to class with a backpack stuffed with $20,000 and he started doling out stacks of $100 bills to her friends. Police are trying to find out how the cash ended up in her bag. And it was a good week for Jake Davidson, a Los Angeles high school senior, who uploaded a whimsical video to YouTube in which he asks Sports Illustrated swimsuit model Kay Upton to his senior prom. Upton tweeted back that she was charmed and might actually go. It was a bad week for hidden messages after viewers of the History Channel miniseries The Bible noticed that the actor playing Satan looked a lot like President Obama. The channel said it was a coincidence. It was a bad week for going greyhound after droves of cockroaches suddenly began dropping from air ducts onto passengers on a New York City-bound bus. There were like 1,000 roaches, said one rider, who joined others in screaming and running off the bus. And it was a bad week for pretending to be good after federal authorities shut down New Jersey's Butterfly Bakery upon finding copious amounts of sugar in its sugar-free items and loads of saturated fat in its fat-free range. The bakery's slogan was, "Goodies that taste good without being bad." Now we'll turn to the briefing section in the Week magazine for this week. It's entitled, "The Jesuits, God's Marines." Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio has become the first Jesuit pope in Catholic Church history. How will that influence him? Who are the Jesuits? Formally called the Society of Jesus, they are the largest single religious order in the Catholic Church. The Society was founded in Paris in 1534 by St. Ignatius Loyola, a Basque soldier who discovered his faith while recuperating from a cannonball wound. He and six fellow students at the University of Paris, including St. Francis Xavier, dedicated themselves to serving the Pope as missionary soldiers of Christ. The order was originally organized along military lines under the leadership of a Father General. Early followers named themselves the Company of Jesus and were nicknamed God's Marines for their willingness to go anywhere in the world at the Pope's command. Pope Paul III recognized them as an order in 1540. Today, there are over 20,000 Jesuits, including missionaries, teachers, and scholars. What are they known for? Well, primarily for their missionary zeal and love for education. Inspired by the Renaissance, Loyola believed the best way of spreading God's word was through establishing Catholic schools. The huge success of a college in Messina, Sicily, prompted him to send members of the order out into Europe and beyond to inaugurate schools, universities, and seminaries. By the time he died in 1556, the Jesuits had founded 74 colleges in Ireland, Germany, Poland, Egypt, India, and Japan. Today, they run 189 colleges across the globe, with 28 in the United States, including Georgetown University and Boston College. Jesuit colleges emphasize free thinking and theological debate, which is why more conservative Catholics consider the order to be dangerously independent. Vincent O'Keefe, an American Jesuit and a former acting Father General, used to joke that Catholics believe the Jesuits know everything but nothing else. Are they respected? Well, they haven't always been. The Jesuits certainly were well regarded during the 16th and 17th centuries when they were viewed as the most pious and most intellectual of priests. Kings of France chose Jesuit confessors for 200 years, but as Catholic Europe disintegrated amid much palace intrigue, the Jesuits' obedience to the papacy made them many enemies. Jesuits were widely viewed as conniving manipulators, and Father Generals were dismissively known as black popes for their supposed control of the Vatican. Anti-Catholics suspected the order of plotting to overturn governments at the Pope's command. The order was eventually dissolved by Pope Clement XIV in 1773 at the urging of anti-clerical kings of Europe. The Jesuits survived in Russia and Prussia until the Pope's edict was rescinded in 1814. But suspicion lingered. If there ever was a body of men who merited eternal damnation on earth and in hell, it is this society of Loyola's, wrote John Adams to Thomas Jefferson in 1816. Adams feared the Jesuits would try to undermine the new republic's separation of church and state. What is their current reputation? The Jesuits are still viewed within the church as the most liberal of the clerical orders with a rebellious bent. Because of their missionary work, particularly in Latin America, the Jesuits developed strong sympathy for desperately poor people subjugated by colonial or military governments. In 1974, the Society decreed that its mission was the service of faith, of which the promotion of justice is an absolute requirement. For some priests, this led naturally to a leftist movement called Liberation Theology, which champions a revolutionary class struggle, pitting the people against the powerful and the wealthy. Some Jesuits actually fought alongside communist guerrillas in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. In 1981, Pope John Paul II, aghast at the political direction the order was taking, overrode the Jesuits' nominee for Father General and appointed a pontifical delegate of his own. That created a split between Jesuits and the Vatican that has not been fully repaired. Will Francis be a Jesuit pope? On matters of sexual morality and the role of women, Bergoglio is first and foremost a traditionalist and not a reformer. In Argentina, he also distanced himself from the liberation theology movement, warning priests it was far too political. Still, Francis shares the Jesuits' intense identification with the power and the powerless, or with the poor and the powerless, rather. He has called the unjust distribution of goods a social sin that cries out to heaven. There's little doubt that Bergoglio's Jesuit concern for social inequality will guide the Vatican's direction in coming years. Like other Jesuits, he also has little regard for hierarchy in itself and the trappings of power. He traveled to work in Buenos Aires by public transport. Those who know him say that the new pope will use his position to do what Jesuits have always done, evangelize, especially in the church's new center of gravity in the southern hemisphere. The election of a Jesuit as pope sends a powerful message, said Father Kevin O'Brien, a Jesuit who is vice president for mission and ministry at Georgetown University. The church has been sidetracked by sexual and financial scandals. Now it's about getting back to the basics. It's about preaching the gospel and helping the poor. And the footnote to this column is entitled The Jesuits' Worldly Achievements. Jesuits have been among the most fervent missionaries in history, evangelizing across the globe and in the process making a huge impact on the secular world. Jesuit explorers founded the city of Sao Paulo, located the source of the Blue Nile, and charted the Amazon and Mississippi rivers. Jesuit missionaries brought rhubarb, quinine, vanilla, and ginseng back from Asia and South America and are believed to have introduced the umbrella to the West. The order's emphasis on learning has also helped it make a significant stride in human knowledge. A Jesuit mathematician, Christopher Chavius, created the modern Gregorian calendar, while Jesuit scientist Athanasius Kircher was the first to discover that the bubonic plague was spread by microorganisms. There are 35 craters on the moon named after Jesuit scientists and astronomers. Less well known, perhaps, is their contribution to the theater. A 17th century Jesuit teacher is thought to have invented the trapdoor. Now we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S., according to The Week magazine. Our first column is entitled, Here Come the Killer Robots. And this one was written by Robert H. Latiff and Patrick McCloskey in the Wall Street Journal. If you think drone warfare has created some tricky moral dilemmas, said Robert Latiff and Patrick McCloskey, just wait until we start sending robotic soldiers into battle. Early prototypes of robots that can hunt down and destroy enemies with ferocious firepower are in development, and what now seems like the stuff of Hollywood fantasy is moving toward realization. Soon, these lethal terminators will be deployed in wars. Why? For the same reason generals and politicians have grown so fond of unmanned aerial drones. They provide extended battle reach without putting our own soldiers at risk. Robot soldiers also cost a tenth of what humans do and never get PTSD or require medical care. That will make them even more attractive as the Pentagon faces tighter budgets. A moral Rubicon lies ahead. Will killer robots on patrol in some foreign city's streets be able to distinguish between large children and small adults? Or between civilians and combatants. If we don't establish moral and legal rules soon, war will evolve into death by algorithm. The next column is entitled Our Two Legal Systems, and it was written by Leonard Pitts, Jr. in the Miami Herald. On every TV cop show, said Leonard Pitts, the arresting officer says to the suspect, "You have a right to an attorney." Americans have taken this right for granted ever since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 1963 that every citizen charged with a crime is entitled to a professional legal defense. But the right has become a myth. In virtually every state, the public defender system is so underfunded and overwhelmed that its lawyers handle 400 to 600 cases a year. Many of these lawyers meet their clients for the first time in court and have no time to do the necessary research on the case. A new book, Chasing Gideon, The Elusive Quest for Poor People's Justice, details what happens as a result. One man, for example, spent 27 years in prison based solely on the testimony of a mentally ill heroin addict with a history of hallucinations. His too busy public defender failed to mention any of that to the jury. Similar injustices occur every day, but are ignored by a society with contempt for the rights, lives, and humanity of the poor. The system is broken. Fix it. And our third column for this week is entitled The Vital Role of Shame in Society by Richard Reeves in the New York Times. Liberals are horrified by a new New York City ad campaign to discourage teen pregnancy, said Richard Reeves. The ad pictures a tear-stained young child who declares to an unseen mom, "I'm twice as likely not to graduate high school because you had me as a teen." Planned Parenthood condemned the ad, saying it was trying to shame teens into responsible sexual behavior. But what's wrong with shame? Shame is an essential ingredient of a healthy society, nudging people toward good behavior rather than compelling it. Some people would prefer a world without any moral judgments, but teenage pregnancy really is a bad choice for the parents and child and society. Society could try to convince teens of this with statistics and rational arguments, but human beings are primarily emotional, not rational creatures. It was shame, not rational argument, that made millions of people give up smoking. It was shame that changed public attitudes toward drunk driving. Shame also made racism and homophobia unacceptable. People should feel bad about some things they do. We need a sense of shame to live well together. And you're listening to our reading of The Week magazine here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we will flip the magazine to the back of the book here at the last word section. And the article this week is entitled Alone in the Taiga, T-A-I-G-A, the Taiga. In 1936, Mike Dash, a Russian family, fled to the wilderness and lived in primitive isolation for decades. Siberian summers don't last long. The snows linger into May and the cold returns in September, freezing the taiga into a still life, awesome in its desolation, endless miles of forests scattered with sleeping bears and hungry wolves, steep-sided mountains, whitewater rivers that pour in torrents through the valleys, 100,000 icy bogs. The taiga stretches from Russia's Arctic regions to Mongolia and east from the Urals to the Pacific, 5 million square miles of nothingness. When the warm days do arrive, the taiga blooms, and for a few months it can seem almost welcoming. It is then that man can see most clearly into this hidden world, not on land, for the taiga can swallow whole armies of explorers, but from the air. Siberia is the source of most of Russia's oil and mineral resources, and over the years, even its most distant parts have been overflown by oil prospectors and surveyors. Thus, it was in the remote south of the forest in the summer of 1978. A helicopter was skimming the tree line 100 or so miles from the Mongolian border when it dropped into a thickly wooded valley. The pilot saw something that should not have been there. It was a clearing 6,000 feet up a mountainside, wedged between the pine and larch and scored with what looked like long, dark furrows. The baffled helicopter crew made several passes before concluding that this was evidence of human habitation. It was an astonishing discovery. The mountain was more than 150 miles from the nearest settlement, in a spot that had never been explored. The Soviet authorities had no records of anyone living in the district. Four scientists sent into the district to prospect for iron ore were told about the pilot's sighting and left their base 10 miles away to investigate. As they scrambled up the mountain, they came across signs of human activity. A rough path, a staff, a log laid across a stream, and finally a small shed filled with birch bark containers of cut-up dried potatoes. Then geologist Galina Pesminskaya said, "Beside a stream, there was a dwelling, blackened by time and rain. The hut was piled up on all sides with taiga, rubbish, bark, poles, planks. The low door creaked, and the figure of a very old man emerged, barefoot. Wearing a patched and repatched shirt made of sacking, he wore trousers of the same material, also in patches, and had an uncombed beard. His hair was disheveled. He looked frightened. Finally, we heard a soft, uncertain voice. 'Well, since you have traveled this far, you might as well come in.'" The sight that greeted the geologists as they entered the cabin was like something from the Middle Ages. The dwelling was not much more than a burrow, a low, soot-blackened log kennel that was as cold as a cellar. Looking around in the dim light, the visitors saw that the single room was cramped, musty, and indescribably filthy, propped up by sagging joists, and astonishingly home to a family of five. The silence was suddenly broken by sobs and lamentations. Only then did we see the silhouettes of two women. One was in hysterics, praying, "This is for our sins." The other, keeping behind a post, sank slowly to the floor. The light from the little window fell on her wide, terrified eyes, and we realized we had to get out of there as quickly as possible. The scientists backed out of the hut and retreated to a spot a few yards away, where they took out some provisions and began to eat. After about a half an hour, the old man and his two daughters emerged. Warily, they approached and sat down with their visitors, rejecting everything that they were offered, jam, tea, bread, with a muttered, "We are not allowed that." When Pesminskaya asked, "Have you ever eaten bread?" the old man answered, "I have, but they have not. They have never seen it." Over several visits, the full story of the family emerged. The old man's name was Karp Lykoff, and he was an old believer, a member of a fundamentalist Russian Orthodox sect, worshiping in a style unchanged since the 17th century. Old believers had been persecuted since the days of Peter the Great, and Lykoff talked about it as though it had happened only yesterday. For him, Peter was a personal enemy and the Antichrist in human form. Things had only gotten worse for the Lykoff family when the atheist Bolsheviks took power. Under the Soviets, isolated old believer communities that had fled to Siberia to escape persecution began to retreat even further from civilization. During the purges of the 1930s, with Christianity itself under assault, a communist patrol had shot Lykoff's brother while Lykoff knelt working beside him. He had responded by scooping up his family and bolting into the forest. That was in 1936, and there were only four Lykoffs then. Karp, his wife, Akalina, a son named Savin, who was 9 years old, and Natalia, a daughter, who was only two. Taking their possessions and some seeds, they had retreated ever deeper into the taiga, until at last they had fetched up in this desolate spot. Two more children had been born in the wild, Dmitri in 1940 and Agafia in 1943, and neither of the youngest Lykoff children had ever seen a human being who was not a member of their family, that is. All that Agafia and Dmitri knew of the outside world, they learned from their parents' stories. The Lykoff children knew there were places called cities where humans lived crammed together in tall buildings. They had heard there were countries other than Russia, but such concepts were no more than abstractions to them. Their only reading matter was prayer books and an ancient family Bible. Akulina had used the Gospels to teach her children to read and write, using sharpened birch sticks dipped into honeysuckle juice as pen and ink. The Lykoffs had carried a crude spinning wheel and the components of a loom into the taiga with them, but they had no technology for replacing metal. A couple of kettles served them well over many years, but when rust finally overcame them, the only replacements they could fashion came from birch bark. Since these could not be placed in a fire, it became far harder to cook. By the time the Lykoffs were discovered, their staple diet was potato patties mixed with ground rye and hemp seeds. It was not until the late 1950s, when Dmitri reached manhood, that they first trapped animals for their meat and skins. Lacking guns and even bows, they could hunt only by digging traps or pursuing prey across the mountains until the animals collapsed from exhaustion. Dmitri built up astonishing endurance and could hunt barefoot in winter, sometimes returning to the hut after several days, having slept in the open in 40 degrees of frost, a younger elk across his shoulders. More often than not, though, there was no meat, and their diet gradually became more monotonous. Famine was in ever-present danger, and in 1961, it snowed in June. The hard frost killed everything in their garden, and by spring, the family had been reduced to eating shoes and bark. Akalina died of starvation. The rest of the family were saved by what they regarded as a miracle. A single grain of rye sprouted in their pea patch. At harvest time, the solitary spike yielded 18 grains, and from this, they painstakingly rebuilt their rye crop. The Soviet geologists slowly got to know the Lykoffs. Old Karp was usually delighted by the latest innovations that the scientists brought up from the camp, and though he refused to believe that man had set foot on the moon, he adapted swiftly to the idea of satellites. The Lykoffs had noticed them as early as the 1950s, when the stars began to go quickly across the sky. Karp held to his status as head of the family, though he was well into his 80s. His eldest child, Savin, dealt with this by casting himself as the family's unbending arbiter in matters of religion. He was strong of faith, but a harsh man, his own father said of him. Certainly the eldest son would have encountered little resistance from Natalia, who always struggled to replace her mother as cook, seamstress, and nurse. The two younger children, on the other hand, were more approachable and more open to change. Fanaticism was not terribly marked in Agafia, the writer Vasily Peskov said, and in time he came to realize that the youngest of the Lykoffs had a sense of irony and could poke fun at herself. She was markedly intelligent and took charge of the difficult task. In a family that possessed no calendars of keeping track of the time. Of all the Lykoffs, though, the geologist's favorite was Dmitri, an outdoorsman who knew all of the taiga's moods. He was the most curious and perhaps the most forward-looking member of the family. He spent days hand-cutting and hand-planning each log that the Lykoffs felled. Perhaps it was no surprise that he was also the most enraptured by the scientists' technology. Once relations had improved to the point that the Lykoffs could be persuaded to visit the Soviets' camp, he spent many happy hours in its little sawmill, marveling at how easily a circular saw and lathes could finish wood. "It's not hard to figure," Peskov wrote. "The log that took Dmitri a day or two to plane was transformed into handsome, even boards before his eyes. Dmitri felt the boards with his palm and said, 'Fine.'" Karp Lykoff fought a long and losing battle with himself to keep all this modernity at bay. When they first got to know the geologist, the family would accept only a single gift, salt. Living without it for four decades, Karp said, had been true torture. Over time, however, they began to take more. They took knives, forks, handles, grain, and eventually even pen and paper, and an electric torch. Perhaps the saddest aspect of the Lykoff strange story was the rapidity with which the family went into decline after they reestablished contact with the outside world. In the fall of 1981, three of the four children died within a few days of one another. Both Savin and Natalia suffered from kidney failure, most likely a result of their harsh diet. But Dmitri died of pneumonia, which might have been as an infection he acquired from his new friends. The geologists attempted to talk Karp and Agafya into leaving the forest and returning to be with relatives who had survived the persecutions of the purge years. But neither of the survivors would hear of it. Karp Lykoff died in his sleep on February 16, 1988. Agafya buried him on the mountain slopes with the help of the geologist, then turned and headed back to her home. The Lord would provide, and as she would say, and she said, as indeed he has. A quarter of a century later, now in her 70s, herself, this child of the taiga, lives alone. And that was an article copyrighted this year by the Smithsonian Institution. Now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the health and science section for this week. Our first article here is entitled, "Our Alarmingly Hot Future." Earth should be gradually cooling, but instead it's heating up at a rate unprecedented in the past 11,300 years. That's the grim news from scientists who analyzed the isotopes and marine fossils from around the world to compile the most complete record of Earth's temperatures yet. The data stretches back to the end of the last ice age, when gradually warming temperatures, brought about by a shift in the Earth's orbit and angle, ushered in the modern Holocene epoch. Then, beginning roughly 5,000 years ago, another shift caused the global average temperatures to begin to cool. That trend likely would have continued, taking us toward another ice age, if it weren't for greenhouse gas emissions, which have reversed the planet's cooling trajectory in a single century. What we found is that temperatures increased in the last 100 years as much as they had cooled in the last 6 or 7,000 years, said Sean Marcotte, a climate scientist at Oregon State University. At its current speed, global warming will heat the planet between 2 and 12 degrees by 2100, challenging many species' ability to adapt. The climate changes to come, Gavin Schmidt, a NASA climate researcher, tells Science, are going to be larger than anything that human civilization has seen in its entire existence. And the health scare of the week, salt and autoimmune disease. Autoimmune diseases such as multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, and type 1 diabetes are on the rise, and scientists now think salty diets may be partly to blame. Researchers notice that the immune systems of people who visited fast food restaurants more than once a week had higher than normal levels of cells that cause inflammation. Those cells, called Th17 cells, ordinarily help repair the body after injury or repel disease-causing pathogens, but in autoimmune diseases, they overmultiply and attack the body's own tissues. When researchers tested salt on the immune cells of mice, they discovered that the more they were exposed to, the more Th17 they produced. And feeding a high-salt diet to mice genetically engineered to develop MS rapidly accelerated the disease. Researchers say that in humans, genes, diet, and environmental factors probably all play a role in autoimmune diseases. Excuse me. Still, study author David Hafler of the Yale School of Medicine tells WebMD.com, "If I had an autoimmune disease, I would put myself on a low-salt diet now." Now we'll turn to the Talking Point section of the Week magazine, our first article entitled Gay Marriage, the Personal Becomes Political. In 1996, then U.S. Representative Rob Portman of Ohio voted for the Defense of Marriage Act, prohibiting federal recognition of same-sex marriage. 3 years later, he voted to prohibit gay couples from adopting. But 2 years ago, his college-age son, Will, told him he was gay. So last week, said Dan Sack in the Washington Post, Portman, now a senator, announced a change of heart, saying he had decided to support same-sex marriage. As a Christian, Portman said he'd wrestled with this decision, but ultimately concluded that all of our sons and daughters ought to have the same opportunity to experience the joys and stability of marriage. Advocates of marriage equality hail the announcement as a turning point, which social conservatives criticize Portman for abandoning his principles. There are absolutes, there is right and wrong, said Traditional Values Coalition President Andrea Lafferty. The tough part of being a parent is telling one of those young souls whom we have been charged with raising that he or she is wrong. Portman deserves credit for standing up to the bigots, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. But pardon me if I don't applaud. As a politician with power over other people's lives, Portman has always had a responsibility to think about the impact of his votes on millions of gay Americans. The fact that he failed to do so until his own son's happiness was at stake is a confession of moral failure. Sadly, said Matthew Iglesias in Slate.com, that failure is typical of conservative politicians. They invariably oppose universal health insurance, food stamps, and other social programs for the simple reason that powerful people never have poor kids. Remember Sarah Palin's sole exception to her scorn for social spending? Right, programs for disabled children like hers. Look, this is how human nature works, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. Portman may have taken the personal route to a more enlightened, compassionate view of gay people, but the real news here is that a conservative Republican now believes he can be true to his heart without committing political suicide. For the GOP, the writing's on the wall, said Chris Saliza in WashingtonPost.com. With 58% of Americans and a staggering 81% of those under 30 now favoring gay marriage. Republicans can't afford to alienate their evangelical Christian base, so over time they just stop talking about the issue entirely. The next item, food, is honest labeling the best policy. There are two kinds of supermarket shoppers these days, said the Springfield, Massachusetts Republican in an editorial. Those who fill their carts with things that taste good, and those who want to know the nutritional information of every single gram of everything contained in any substance they might put in their mouths. The second kind will be celebrating this week after upmarket emporium Whole Foods announced that it would become the first retailer in the country to label all goods containing genetically modified organisms in its 339 stores by 2018. This is an issue whose time has come, said Whole Foods co-chief executive Walter Robb. Customers have a fundamental right to know what's in their food. How can anyone argue with that principle, said Karen Klein in the Los Angeles Times. The biotech industry and corporations like Monsanto and DuPont recently sank millions of dollars into defeating including Proposition 37, the California initiative requiring label of any foods containing GMOs. But now, thanks to Whole Foods, customers will rightly get the transparency they deserve, so they'll know whether the DNA of their dinner has been tinkered with in a laboratory. About 70% of processed foods already contain GMO corn and soy, and in coming years, other genetically modified produce or even fish and meat might reach supermarkets. The new policy, which will put pressure on other stores to follow along, just gives customers control over their diets. Best of all, the new labeling is not being forced by heavy-handed government regulation, said the Dallas Morning News. Instead, we have a perfect example of the free market giving consumers what they want without forcing it on the rest of the marketplace. And now, as we reach the end of our program for this week, here are a few short items from the Talking Points section. South America has 339 million Catholics, and Africa 186 million. Canada and the U.S. combined have just 86 million. Chinese doctors have performed 336 million abortions and 196 million sterilizations since it began encouraging small families in 1971. Without the country's one-child policy, China says its 1.35 billion population would be 30% larger. Amtrak ridership has risen 55% since 1997, a new study has found. In the shorter city-to-city routes from Boston to Washington and San Diego to Los Angeles, Amtrak actually makes a profit. Losses come from the little-traveled long-distance routes in other parts of the country. Of the National Rifle Association's 75-person board of directors, 95% are white and 87% are male. And the amount of time a sample of local TV newscast devoted to stories about government and politics fell to 3% last year, down from 7% in 2005. That's from a new Pew Research study. With reporting staffs shrinking, 40% of the average newscast was taken up by segments about weather, sports, and traffic. And the poll watch for this week, 53% of Americans say the 2003 invasion of Iraq was a mistake. 73% of Democrats think the Iraq War was a mistake, but only 30% of Republicans agree. And 56% of working mothers and 50% of working fathers say they find it difficult to balance work and family life. 60% of two-parent families have two working parents. Well, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.